Thank you, Mr. Henderson, and good afternoon to you all. We have a bit of a break from our heat and the incessant sunshine. Just been a terrible summer that way, hasn't it? I think we've all at least appreciated that, and it's not often that we get that long a run of such good weather. It seems unfortunate that it's combined with the other issues we're dealing with this year. I appreciated Mr. Pavlik's reference to the one sermon possible from that verse that talks about the qualities of godly wisdom. I don't know how far back I'd have to go, but it's back there in the files somewhere, based on Proverbs 9:1, which talks about wisdom has builded her house. She has hewn out her seven pillars. And if I recall correctly, if you put the one sort of combined description there in James together, you do come up with seven different qualities. So it's there, but you can use it too. Go ahead. One of the cutest and most interesting parts of the teen camp, the virtual preteen camp for CAGWA, I think this year, Church of God Worldwide Association, was the chance for the young campers to give a short video message on who they were, where they went to church, and what they were interested in. Then it was posted on the interactive website app Flipgrid, which they used for the camp program. And my wife and I were scrolling through looking at some of those and enjoying them. Yeah, we saw some of you guys there. You were hiding. We waved, but you didn't wave back. I don't know what was going on with that. But anyway, for some strange reason, I was most drawn to the one by a very precocious 7-year-old young man who lives in Walton, Kentucky, attends church in Cincinnati, and likes frogs, according to his little video that he put on there. I'll give you 3 guesses who that is and why I was so interested. That's the problem with grandpas. You know, what are you going to do about them? And they just they hang around forever. Well, not quite, but for a while. Another thought. On the Life, Hope, and Truth website, you'll notice that there is a short bio, and it's expandable if you want to read a bit more about the authors of the articles on the site. Of course, we're responsible to keep those things updated with Mr. Bennett. Like if we add grandchildren or things change materially, we're supposed to update those. I noticed my brother had his for a while. It said something about his interests and how he was interested in sports. And it said at the end, it says he hopes that one day his beloved Kansas City Chiefs will make it back to the Super Bowl. So I spotted that and sent it to him. I said, you better contact Mike Bennett because that one needs to be updated now. This is after this past February. But those are little glimpses into the lives of those who write on some of the websites. It tells you a little story about them and their lives. Just out of curiosity, those of you who are here, how many of you have participated in a speech club of some sort, like the Old Spokesman Club, the Teen Club, any of those things, ambassador clubs, if you went to the ambassador college, how many? Quite a few hands, women's clubs. We had women's clubs with various activities and speeches. That's quite a few in the group here. And in many of those clubs, the very first speech assignment has always been familiar, has been the same. It was an icebreaker, and that's what it was called in many of the clubs. The subject, well, it was one that the speaker was supposed to know pretty well because it was you. You were supposed to give a little bit of a talk about yourself, about where you came from, perhaps how you became interested in the truth of God and how you came to the church of God. And I guess you could call it, what's my story? Would be one possible way of looking at it. It helps new speakers break the ice, get into the swing of speaking before a group, which sometimes is a kind of a scary prospect for people, and especially for newcomers who are not used to it. I'd like you to think about that today a little bit in the time for this second message, this second split sermon. What is your story? I think you'll find that the messages actually do blend very well today. In fact, I texted Mr. Pavlik earlier today and I said, by the way, if you're using this particular blog, I just want to know, any chance of using this blog from 3 years ago by this particular writer as some source material for your sermon today? I didn't get an answer and didn't get an answer. And then he wrote back and he says, that's my whole message. Then he wrote back and said, no, it's not. He said, I haven't actually read that one. What am I talking about when I ask, what is your story? Let's begin with an example from Old Testament Israel. Turn back to the book of 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 13. It says in verse 1, Saul reigned 1 year. And when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, he chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel. 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and in the mountains of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan, that was his son, in Gibeah of Benjamin. The rest of the people he sent away, every man to his tent. So he didn't have a large standing army, just 3,000 men. And Jonathan attacked the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear, descendants of Eber. Of course, that's a more general term even than Israelite, but it referred to them, and they knew what he was talking about. Now all Israel heard it said that Saul had attacked a garrison of the Philistines. Well, actually, his son had. And that Israel had also become odious to the Philistines, the margin says. And the people were called together to Saul at Gilgal. So now he needs more of that army. Then the Philistines gathered together to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen. Now remember, Israel's army had only been 3,000 as a standing army. And now they're going to be opposed by 30,000 charioteers and 6,000 horsemen or cavalry, and people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude. We're not even told how many foot soldiers they had. So there's a call that goes out. We need soldiers. We need men. And they came up and encamped in Michmash to the east of Beth-Aven. So that gives us a bit of an idea of what was happening and how scary it looked. When the men of Israel saw that they were in danger, for the people were distressed, then the people hid in caves, in thickets, in rocks, in holes, in pits. And some of the Hebrews crossed over the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. Some of them took off. As for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. We get a real sense of what was happening here. Then he waited 7 days, according to the time set by Samuel. But Samuel didn't come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. His army that had recently swelled in to support began to dissipate. We already read about some of them were hiding in caves and thickets, rocks, holes, pits. So Saul said, bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me. And he offered the burnt offering. Now it happened, as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering, that Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him that he might greet him or bless him, that Samuel might bless Saul. It has never occurred to Saul at this point, apparently, that he has done anything problematic, anything wrong. Now you can sort of understand in a way, when I read the circumstances and pointed them out, how desperate it looked for Israel. They desperately wanted God to know God was with them. But Samuel had given instructions that he would be there at a certain time. It doesn't actually say whether he was late or not, does it? It just says he waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel. But what we see is that it appears that as soon as he finished giving this offering, which he wasn't supposed to do, here's Samuel. We've got a problem. Let me quote from a blog written 3 years ago by one of our very gifted writers. This one does not appear in the church's publications, but it's his own blog. Some of you would recognize the concept of Sabbath thoughts. The people were terrified, and for that matter, so was their king. They found themselves at the brink of war with an enemy whose army was as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude. We just read those words. The threat was enough to send grown men scampering to hide wherever they could find shelter, in caves, in thickets, in holes, in rocks, in pits. The men brave enough to remain followed their king, trembling, to the place where a prophet would make a sacrifice of supplication to God on behalf of the entire nation. They waited 7 days, the time set by the prophet himself, but he didn't come. A week of waiting for nothing. Some of the people, disillusioned by the turn of events, began to disperse, and the king could do nothing but watch. His people were losing faith in him. A powerful nation had gathered at his borders to destroy him, and the prophet of God had abandoned him. Unless he did something soon, everything would be lost. So he took action. He broke all convention and offered the sacrifice on his own. Someone had to, after all, and if the prophet wouldn't do it, why couldn't the king? He had no sooner finished presenting the sacrifice when he found himself face to face with the absentee prophet. "What have you done?" the prophet asked him. The king, desperate to justify himself, rattled off a string of excuses. The people were leaving. You were late. The army of the enemy was at our doorstep. I had no choice. Saul had an excuse for disobeying God. But then he always had an excuse. He had an excuse for the sacrifice. He had an excuse for not killing King Agag. He had an excuse for taking the best of the plunder from an accursed city. There was always, always a reason. Always a justification. But Saul had more than excuses. He had a narrative. And so do you, says this blog. And I would add, and so do I. What's your story? The blog goes on to cite a businessman and author. Author Seth Godin explains the concept of a narrative this way. So this is from another blog. In fact, all of us have a narrative. It's the story we tell ourselves about how we got here, what we're building, what our urgencies are. And within that narrative, we act in a way that seems reasonable. To be clear, the narrative isn't true. It's merely our version, our self-talk about what's going on. It's the excuses, perceptions, and history we have woven together to get through the world. It's our grievances and our perception of privilege, our grudges, and our loves. No one is unreasonable. Or, to be more accurate, this author says, no one thinks that they are being unreasonable. That's why we almost never respond well when someone points out how unreasonable we're being. We don't see it because our narrative of the world won't allow us to. That's pretty well written, I think. And it touches on something that Mr. Pavlik also mentioned in his message today, the first message. He said he doesn't like being, you know, corrected or chastened. Or none of us can say, I like it. Just bring it on. Now, more correction, more criticism. That's what I want. But sometimes we have to think about where we're coming from. When we hear those words from those blogs, do we see how that matches King Saul exactly? And the way he reacted to Samuel. We read the first 10 verses here in 1 Samuel 13, and there doesn't appear to be anything indicating Saul was tumbling to the fact he had done something very badly wrong, because he finally sees Samuel and he goes out to meet Samuel expecting to be blessed. Let's pick it up in verse 11. And Samuel said, "What have you done?" Saul said, "When I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that you didn't come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said, 'The Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal, and I haven't made supplication to the Lord. Therefore, I felt compelled, and I offered a burnt offering.'" There's Saul's story. There's Saul's narrative. If you were to ask Saul, "What's your story?" you just read it. His reason for his conduct here. But look at the reaction from Samuel, verse 13. "And Samuel said to Saul, 'You have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now he would have established your kingdom over Israel forever.'" I don't know exactly how that would have worked. We know that Jesus Christ was going to be born of the tribe of Judah, and Saul was of the tribe of Benjamin, so I'm not sure how all those things would have played out. But we have to accept it at face value that God had something in mind that he would have given Saul beyond just his own reign. "But now your kingdom shall not continue," verse 14. "The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." And we know, of course, that was David. Interesting, isn't it? Samuel is told by Saul, he goes up to him and when he takes in what has happened, that Saul has overstepped his authority and overstepped his bounds. That even as king, he was not supposed to be the one making petition to God. It was supposed to be through the prophet or the judge that Samuel was. And basically his answer is, "I had no choice. I had no choice. And part of it's your fault, Samuel. If you'd been here yesterday, we'd have been fine." And so in Saul's mind, he did nothing wrong. According to Saul's narrative, Saul's story, everything was still okay. If you take the time to go through and study a bit about the life of Saul, and I still recall a presentation at the Winter Family Weekend, probably about 5 years ago by Mr. Kylo, and it was entitled, "Saul, A Man After Man's Own Heart." And that pretty much said it all, too. I did look back at some of those notes to refresh my memory about certain things when I was preparing this sermon. When we read more about Saul and his kind of thinking, we see that he never really changed his story, did he? He never really changed it. Saul could never view the world in any other basic way than exactly what we see here. The result, of course, in this circumstance is exactly what Samuel told him it would be. God replaced him with David, who, despite making some pretty terrible choices and some awful sins that he engaged in, had a different response to God when he was corrected. And therein was the difference. Samuel's prophecy here in verse 14 of 1 Samuel 13, "The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart," was accurate. That man was David. And brethren, this is where you and I come in. Now, we're never going to be kings or queens or anything over a great nation in this life. I can pretty much rest assured of that, and I think you can too. So we won't have that kind of power or influence at our disposal. But we have lives to live, and you heard a lot about what that kind of life should focus on in the first message today. On godly wisdom. On looking for the truth. And if you use that phrase, "the truth," for us, that better refer to what is coming out of this book. Because there's precious little that can bear that title in our world. Do we have a story? What's your story? What's my story? Every human being has a story. Every human being has a narrative. In some ways, so does every group of humans. Whether political parties, they have their stories, they have their narratives. Social movements, businesses, churches, schools, neighborhood associations, the entertainment industry, sports leagues, they all have their narratives. Everyone. Everyone. Let me read another quote from that blog. Identifying our narrative is tricky business. We don't mentally file it under a folder called the story I tell myself about how the world works. That's not where it's filed up here. Do you know where it's filed? Do you know what the name of the folder is in our head? We file it instead in a folder called How the World Works. Don't we? Sure we do. And when someone challenges that story, when someone tells us we're wrong, that we're not seeing things correctly, we bristle. We open up the folder, we point to it, and we say, no, you're wrong. This is how it works. Because I found it in my folder that says how the world works. That's our story. All of us. As if it's the gospel truth, this blog writer goes on to say, as if the story we tell ourselves is flawless, bulletproof, unassailable. Because to us, it's not a story. It's reality, not to be challenged, not to be questioned. That was Saul's problem. Saul was never wrong, even when God told him he was. Isn't that rather telling? Saul was never wrong, even when God told him he was. He had reasons for performing the offering. The people were leaving. The Philistines were coming. Samuel was late. He had a reason for not utterly destroying the nation of Amalek, the Amalekites. The people wanted to offer the best of the plunder to God. He could always justify his disobedience because within his narrative, what he was doing always made sense. Isn't that what happens to any of us, brethren, when we go off the track? As Mr. Pavlik was going through some of the descriptions there, I had to realize that some of that would bring any one of us up short in some of our own words and actions at some point in our lives. Sometimes we see things in the world of social media that distress us terribly. And we have to ask if only these precious people could read those words in the book of James and ask, where do my words fit? I hope it would get through. Goes on in this blog, Saul couldn't see that his narrative was setting him at odds with his Creator. He couldn't see that his narrative was the very thing causing him to lose his grip on his kingdom. He couldn't accept that maybe, just maybe, he was looking at the world the wrong way. Here's my question today. What about you and what about me? Can we accept, if we see it from an unimpeachable source, and this one certainly is, that our narrative isn't right? That it has flaws? That it needs to be edited? That we need to take a big red pen and cross out sections of it and rewrite it to make it match this? Can we do that? I said earlier that the man who was prophesied to take King Saul's place was David. We all know that. And we know that some of the really bad choices, the terrible sins he committed, were every bit as bad, it seems, as what Saul did. We should also know what the big difference was from Saul's life. Turn to 2 Samuel chapter 12. I'm not going to turn to chapter 11, the tawdry episode with Bathsheba, Uriah, and that whole thing. This blog writer says in another place, I'm not going to quote from that or cite that, but he says we don't even know what else happened in that year in David's life. We just have this bare minimum of it. But in 2 Samuel 12 and verse 1, "And the Lord sent Nathan to David. Samuel was sent to Saul, another prophet. Nathan is sent to David. And he came to him and he said, 'There were two men in one city, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had exceedingly many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb which he had bought and nourished. And it grew up together with him and with his children. It ate of his own food and it drank from his own cup, and it lay in his bosom and it was like a daughter to him. And a traveler came to the rich man who refused to take from his own flock and from his own herd to prepare one for the wayfaring man who had come to him. He took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him.' So he served dinner, this poor man's lamb." Look at the reaction from David. David's anger was greatly aroused against the man. And he said to Nathan, "As the Lord lives, the man who has done this shall surely die, or deserves to die, or is a son of death." Those are all possible translations from the Hebrew. "And he shall restore fourfold for the lamb because he did this thing and because he had no pity." Look at Nathan's words. "Then Nathan said to David, 'You are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your keeping and gave you the house of Israel and Judah. If that had been too little, I would have given you much more. Why have you despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil in his sight? You have killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword." And as a side point, there's another reference in the record somewhere else that lists him as one of the 37 mighty men of Israel. He was one of the nation's heroes. "You have taken his wife to be your wife and have killed him with the sword of the people of Ammon." Put him in a battlefield position where he couldn't survive. "Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, I will raise up adversity against you from your own house, and I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of this son." That's rather graphic. "For you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel," before the sun, or we might say out in the open. We know what Saul's reaction was to Samuel. What was David's reaction to Nathan when Nathan said, "Your narrative is wrong"? Verse 13, "So David said to Nathan, 'I have sinned against the Eternal, against the Lord.'" That's quite a different response. That's quite a different response. We would look at it and we could say, how in the world did he ever get so far off track? And the answer is, I don't know. I don't know, except human nature is not pretty and it's capable of some things sometimes we'd rather not think about. But look at the reaction. Look at the response. Where Saul made excuses, David just said, "I have sinned against God." Do you know what David was doing? David was handing that folder that says what I tell myself about how the world works. And he was opening it up and he was handing it to God. And he was saying, "Please edit my folder. Please change what's written there. Because it's obvious to me it's not right." Saul checked the folder and turned around and, as if to speak to God in responding to Samuel, said, "I didn't do anything wrong. This is the way the world works. The enemy was at the gates. You were late. Who else would do it? The army was dispersing. The enemy was gathering. I had to. I had no choice." And he clasped that folder close to himself and put it back in his file cabinet in his head. Only he thought it said, "How the world works." There's a big difference. David wanted his folder to be more than just my story. He wanted it to be God's story in David's life. Turn to Psalm 51. Psalm 51 and verse 1, "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to your loving kindness. According to the multitude of your tender mercies, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity. Cleanse me from my sin. For I acknowledge my transgressions. My sin is always before me. Against you, you only, have I sinned and done this evil in your sight, that you may be found just when you speak. When you tell me my folder has wrong information, I believe you. And blameless when you judge." That's a very different response than Saul's. Here's David's heartfelt prayer. I won't go through the rest of the chapter, but you know it well, I'm sure. This is where he asked God to write a new story on his heart and mind, to make it a truer story than the one that he had written so far. And all of us as human beings, we all have a tendency to say, "But my story's already true." Because that's the way we think of it. That's the way we see it. Of course we say that. We don't think the story is false. We have the story because we think it's true, because we think it's accurate. We think it's how the world works. But if we come up against God's instructions and God's words and his directions, and something's got to give, we need to know what should give. We're all human. We're not infallible like God. Our mental folder doesn't really have the subject line, "How the world works." It has the subject line, "How I think the world works," or "How I tell myself the world works." We need God to help us keep editing our story, to make it more like the one he wants for us, to make it closer to being the way the world works. Or we might even add, the way God's plan works. To do that, there are some key scriptures that we all know and we have to keep thinking about as we grow in God's ways. Turn to Isaiah 66. These are not unfamiliar, but think of it in this connection, in connection with that folder in your head and the folder in my head. Isaiah 66, verse 1. "Thus says the Lord," or the Eternal One, the Ever-Living One, "Heaven is my throne, and earth is my footstool. Where is the house that you will build me? And where is the place of my rest? For all those things my hand has made, and all those things exist, says the Lord, but on this one will I look, on him who is poor and of a contrite spirit and who trembles at my word." Back in Saul's experience, the trembling was being done by the soldiers of Israel and probably by their king too, but not at the right thing. They weren't trembling at the correction that Samuel had to pass on. They were trembling at the physical danger of the enemy. We could say, "I understand it," and we could. You know, I'm sure we all read that verse. We read verses in the Bible that say, "What can man do to me?" And physically we say, "Well, there's a lot man can do to me." But we have to understand where it's coming from and what he means. Isaiah 66 is a huge marker for all of us. Which king of Israel do these verses describe? Pretty easy to spot, isn't it? It's David, not Saul. What about you and what about me? Where do we fit here? Can we open our mental folders and hand it up to God? Can you and I hand our folders up to God and ask Him to make changes in it so that it's more like He is and more like His Son is, and so that the title could be a little closer to how the world works? David's son Solomon took the throne after his father David died. You heard a little bit about him today. And you know, he started out rather well. In 2 Kings chapter 3, God first contacts him directly in a dream. That's not where I want to go. Let's try 1 Kings 3. I'm quite sure that's going to be a little more accurate. 1 Kings 3, beginning in verse 4. Now the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night. And God said, "Ask, what shall I give you?" You heard a little bit about this in the first message. What prompted Solomon to ask this? Very possibly the teaching from his father David. And Solomon said, because look who he references here, "You have shown great mercy to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in truth, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart with you. You have continued this great kindness for him, and you have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David, but I am a little child." We don't know how old he was exactly. Some traditions say perhaps 17, quite young. But we also know that he reigned 40 years as his father David did and as Saul did. So if he was 17, he didn't live a very long life, did he? 40 plus 17 is only 57. But whatever the case, "Now, O Lord my God," he says, "you've made your servant king and I'm a child. I don't know how to go out or come in." That isn't the mark of someone who is egotistical. That is a humble statement. In some ways unusual in youth. "And your servant is in the midst of your people, whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours?" And as we might expect, it says the speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. And he goes on to promise him other things because he had asked good things to serve. While he was still asking for God's mercy and God's help in writing his story of how the world works, he wrote some rather wise things. Turn to Proverbs 26 and look at another one. Proverbs 26, we'll pick it up in verse 3. And I'll read a few verses and see if you can figure out what the subject is of these verses. Proverbs 26:3, "A whip for the horse, a bridle for the donkey, but a rod for the fool's back. Don't answer a fool according to his folly, lest you also be like him. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes." That demands discernment on our parts. "He who sends a message by the hand of a fool cuts off his own feet and drinks violence. Like the legs of the lame that hang limp is a proverb in the mouth of fools." Proverb is supposed to be a wise saying, but he says if it's in the mouth of fools, it's just dangling there. It's doing nothing. "Like one who binds a stone in a sling is he who gives honor to a fool. Like a thorn that goes into the hand of a drunkard is a proverb in the mouth of fools. The great God who formed everything gives the fool his hire and the transgressor his wages. As a dog returns to his own vomit, so a fool repeats his folly." Now, I'm going to ask you what you think the subject matter is. You know what it's not about? It's not about fools. Read the next verse. Do you see a man wise in his own eyes? There is more hope for a fool than for him. That's quite the setup, isn't it? Verse after verse after verse about fools, and then he does a quick 180 on us and says, by the way, I'm not really talking about fools, because there's more hope for them than for someone who is wise in his own eyes. Isn't that someone who has a folder that says how the world works, when it really ought to say the things I tell myself about how the world works? I think so. Wise words, very wise. You know something, brethren? I'm sure we all know it. The trick is to operate according to it. The truth is that no human's folder is gospel truth. No human's folder is gospel truth. Whose folder is gospel truth? Turn to the book of James, chapter 1. James chapter 1, verse 22. But be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man observing his natural face in a mirror. He observes himself, he goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty, who's the originator of that law? And continues in it, and is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this one will be blessed in what he does. So when we jump to the New Testament, James is talking about mirrors and hearers and doers. But isn't this really the same thing we've been talking about all along today? Are we the ones who look at God's mind revealed in his law and in all of his word, and we keep looking at it? And we continue in it, because that's what James talks about. Isn't that really saying that we're opening our folders, and then we're opening the words in God's folder, and then we're putting them side by side together, and then we get out our red editing pen, and we start making changes in our folder when we see the need? That sure seems like what we should be doing by continuing to look in this word. In this folder. Paul had something to say about those mental folders too in 2 Corinthians 10. Verse 3. Though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. Those are interesting words. What does he mean by casting down arguments? What are we talking about when he says high thing, every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God? What could that be? Well, we just have to read the rest of the verse. Bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, and being ready to punish all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled. Isn't he saying the battle is in our own minds? Isn't he saying we're fighting against any of our thoughts that aren't accurate? We're opening our folder, which says how the world works, and all of a sudden we take that red pen and we cross it out and say the things I tell myself about how the world works. And then we start editing. We look at God's folder, his word, and we look at ours. We look at God's, and we look at ours. And we keep looking at God's, and we start making adjustments as we need to. That's where the change comes in. Bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. So it turns out it wasn't just Saul, and it wasn't just David. It's everybody. It's everyone. Verses 12 and 18 in this same chapter seem to fit the theme too. Verse 12 says, "We dare not class ourselves or compare ourselves with those who commend themselves. But they, measuring themselves by themselves, comparing themselves among themselves, are not wise." If we've got to make comparisons, let's get out God's folder. Let's get out this book. And verse 18, "Not he who commends himself is approved, but whom the Lord commends." You know, I think you can almost use the word amens in that verse too, to make changes, as God helps us make changes. And of course, there's that one reference in Philippians 2. I'll just read it, and we're very familiar with it. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 5. "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus." That's what we're striving to do. We're striving to have our folder look more and more like His folder. And His really does say how the world works, and how my plan works, and how everything works. And that's what we want ours to look like. It describes what kind of mindset he had in the next three verses. And we're very familiar with it. Like I said at the beginning of this message, I sure did enjoy some of the material about the virtual preteen camp and that I was able to view. Not as much. My wife took much more time with it. I kept hearing giggles coming from her office and her study, and I'd go in there and find out what was happening. And they were pretty funny, some of them. Some of the ones who enjoyed frogs held out the frog for everybody to get a good look at it. You know, that's pretty helpful too. She passed on some of the cute material she saw. Maybe the most enjoyable were the little segments that we could call My Story. Who are these young ones growing up in front of our eyes, changing into young men and young women when we blink our eyes? And we all have our story, we've found. But being human, it has a few things that need to be reworked to make it more like it needs to be. So let me finish with one more quote from the original blog that I started with. This writer ends the blog by saying, "The truth is, the only one with a perfect understanding of the world is God. The best way to deceive ourselves is to do what Saul did, to look in the mirror and then walk away, to hear and not do. We'll quickly forget what kind of person we are and go back to telling ourselves the stories that sound good to us. The best way to avoid that ditch is to do what David did, to look in the mirror and then keep on looking. When we hear God's word and engage with it on a regular basis, it's going to change us, transform us. When we're willing to see who we are instead of what we want to see, God can work with us, mold us, and begin to show us where our narratives need some work. As James says, that requires doing. David acted on what he was shown in God's mirror, but Saul refused. Thousands of years later, we face the same choice. Everyone has a narrative. More importantly, everyone has an imperfect narrative. They're filled with flaws and holes and misconceptions that God is willing to help us fix if we're willing to let Him. The easiest and most effective way to do that is not to wait until God has to send a Samuel or a Nathan with a wake-up call. It's to dig into God's Word, to study, and then to take what we're shown and put it into practice. The more we do that, the more God will help us develop a better and more accurate narrative. So, what's your story?